When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. I'm Travis Dow.
And I'm Pete Coleman from the Bohemican podcast.
Tonight we're going to talk about Paracelsus. Now that's not his given name. He was born Philippus Aurelius Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim.
Are you serious?
Really? Dude, I find that extremely disrespectful.
I'm just saying.
Actually, some people think that the word bombastic comes from his name, really? But it's not actually. No. That's a myth, but partially because he had a huge ego. But anyway, so he was born from 1493 to 1541 and was Swiss-German. Okay, so he's a Renaissance physician, botanist, alchemist, astrologer, hermeticist, and Neoplatonist.
A man about town. He's had a huge resume.
That covers everything in this podcast. So, Paracelsus means equal to or greater than Celsus, which Celsus refers to a Roman encyclopedist, Aulus Cornelius Celsus, from the first century, known for his tract on medicine. So a very famous guy in his time as well. Now, again, this kind of shows his overbearing ego that would get him in trouble many, many times. He studied medicine at the University of Basel, later moving to Vienna, and he gained his doctorate degree from the University of Ferrara around 1515.
His wanderings as an itinerant physician and sometime journeyman miner took him through nations such as Germany, France, Spain, Hungary, the Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, and Russia. He got around. After so many issues with other physicians, he had a reputation, by the way, for being very arrogant.
Did we mention that already?
Yeah, he had an ego the size of Texas and was kicked out of the faculty at the University of Basel and the University of Leipzig, refusing to print his works. So, in essence, when they asked him to publish or perish, he decided to perish. Mm-hmm. He was kicked out. He wandered further throughout Europe, Africa, and Asia Minor, some say in India as well as the Holy Land, in pursuit of hidden knowledge. Mm-hmm. So he was a traveling man. He revised old manuscripts and wrote new ones, but had trouble finding publishers. Don't we all?
Yeah.
In 1536, the great surgery book, which is known as, Travis?
Die große Wundarznei.
Thank you very
much. I don't know what your problem was with that.
German's just not my native tongue. So, yeah. The Great Surgery Book was published and enabled to him to regain his fame. So that really brought him back to what everybody knew. He died at the age of 48 of natural causes. His remains were buried according to his wishes in the cemetery at the church at St. Sebastian in Salzburg. His remains are now located in the tomb in the porch of the church.
Yeah, I was just in Salzburg and did not know that.
It's a beautiful city.
Yeah.
But evidently his eternal home.
Yep. So we've seen this before. When someone gets labeled an alchemist, and especially in the field of medicine, the things they have in common is that they scrapped the old books and went out into the field and did their own things. This was, we talked about this in Albertus Magnus, Al-Ghazali, so they all have this in common that they just... that experience and expertise is better than books, okay? So what's interesting is this, his life is connected to the birth of Lutheranism. So this is in the time of the Reformation. His opinions on the nature of the universe are better understood if you understand that, the context of this religious movement and these ideas circulating around in his lifetime. So for instance, he thought, like I just said, like experience and expertise is better than knowledge. And he even went so far as burning the book of Avicenna. So he has that in common with Al-Ghazali. I don't think Al-Ghazali burned the books, but he definitely was anti-Avicenna. If you want to hear more about that, listen to the Al-Ghazali podcast. And another thing he did that was kind of related to this Lutheranism is that he taught in German instead of Latin.
A key part to the whole Reformation aspect of taking the language to the people – and this time speaking in the native tongue of German.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So his hands-on experience got him a reputation as a magician, okay? And this is, I mean, he was actually against magic. But this is just like Albertus Magnus. So can I plug another show?
You
should, if you want to hear more about that, listen to the Albertus Magnus podcast. So as a physician of the early 16th century, Paracelsus held a natural affinity with the Hermetic, Neoplatonic, and Pythagorean philosophies central to the Renaissance, a worldview exemplified by Marsilio, Ficino, and Pico della Mirandola. Paracelsus rejected the magic theories of Agrippa and Flamel in his Archidoxes of Magic. Now, Flamel we'll do a podcast on because he's kind of the quintessential alchemist. In fact, if you watched Harry Potter, he is...
Nicholas Flamel.
Nicholas Flamel is...
No kidding.
Albertus Dumbledore's friend, or yeah, it's like he was still alive in the movie Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah, because he was living forever. Is that right?
Yeah, because yeah. he had the elixir of life. He needed the Philosopher's Stone to make the elixir of life, which is not quite canon alchemy, but I'll allow it.
No, I do. You're bringing back memories now. Yeah, absolutely. And he would later, when he gave up the stone. He was going to die of natural causes.
Yeah, so but he said that he had like enough for like 200 more years or something, so it wasn't a big deal. Yeah. Something like that. But you're kind of outing me as a Harry Potter fan here.
Was not my intention.
I've seen the movie several times.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyways, he's from Harry Potter fame. And again, Paracelsus was against this guy. So he thought that this guy was too into the occult. Paracelsus was more feet on the ground, you know, doing the research. So he does often write in alchemical languages and terms, but when he mentions transmutation, he's like Al-Ghazali. It means turning a weak soul into a healthy one, okay? And in his case, specifically, turning ingredients into medicine. Now, this is revolutionary. We'll talk about this in a second.
So this is transmutation.
Yep.
We talked about before, which mm-hmm. is almost a key element to the concept
of
alchemy.
In this sense, transmutation is a word of turning flour, eggs, milk, and water into cookies, okay? Oh, and sugar, if you want them to be sweet. I mean, this is you know, turning ingredients into medicine, or this is, you know, in that kind of sense of turning one thing into another. Chemistry is full of transmutation. But, so he wasn't totally feet on the ground. And this is common for the time. He based his medicine in astrology. So, you know, you can't do certain things unless a certain planet is in a certain constellation or a certain phase of the moon or whatever. He also invented an alphabet called the Alphabet of the Magi to write angelic names on talismans, which had healing power. So while he may have revolutionized medicine in some way, he still clung to some old beliefs in other ways, which, again, was very normal at the time.
So this leads us to the three substances. The three substances we'll talk about in one moment, but I'll give you an idea that Paracelsus believed in the Greek concept of four elements. But he also introduced the idea that, in another level, the cosmos is fashioned from three spiritual substances, the tria prima, mercury, sulfur, and salt. And what this will sound all very familiar to those who have looked into alchemy or listened to the show before. We've talked about this ad infinitum, that these substances were not just the simple substances that we recognize today, but were rather broad principles that they gave to an object in both inner essence and outer form. So mm-hmm. what we think of in this idea of tria prima, mercury, sulfur, and salt are not actually mercury, sulfur, and salt, but representative of something else. Great. So mercury represented the transformative agent of fusibility and volatility. Sulfur represented the binding agent between substance and transformation, flammability, for mm-hmm. instance.
Yeah.
And salt represented the solidifying and substantive agent, fixing things together and non-combustibility.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, for example, when a piece of wood is burnt, the product reflects its constitution. Smoke reflects the mercury, flame reflects the sulfur, and ash reflects the salt.
And there's, you know, you still see the elements. There's air, earth, fire, and water in there. So it's kind of addition to those, right?
It's all coming together. Yeah. The tria prima also defined the human identity. Sulfur embodies the soul, the emotions, and the desires. Salt represents the body. And Mercury epitomizes the spirit, imagination, moral judgment, and the higher mental faculties. So by understanding the chemical nature of the tria prima, the physician could discover the means of curing all disease. He stated that he was not after gold or silver, which sounds Neoplatonic, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But after maybe a grander idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So transmutation. Again, something that's been part of the common thread going through alchemy. Cloth to paper, wood to coal, but also metal to stone and stone to coal. So,
which doesn't, you know, some of those, yeah, cloth to paper, sure. But on the other hand, metal to stone, what? So they clearly, they believed in a simple concept, like water and flour is dough, but they also had some weird ideas of, and this goes back to mining, and you know, if you find ore in stone, they might think that it's just not ripe yet. So not all the stone has turned to gold. Or you find, like some of these alchemist ideas come from that, I think I've mentioned this before, but in a mine, when you find gold ore, there's some lead in there. Or if you find copper ore, there's some silver in there. So like Michel Sedzivoy, he took this to the next level and said, well, it's just, you know, it's not ripe yet. You know, you can see in nature how lead is turning to gold. You just need to find out how nature does it and transmutate this. So, you know, he did ascribe to those philosophies. He just wasn't after that. He was a doctor. He was a medic at heart. So he still wrote about these alchemist ideas of calcination, sublimation, solution, putrefaction, distillation, coagulation, tincture. If you do any reading of alchemy, these words just come up and up, you know, over and over again. This is like if you're reading a recipe to how to make gold, these are the words that they use. In fact, this is from him. So he wrote about the Philosopher's Stone, and this is kind of paraphrased because it's very strange sounding if you just read it. But basically, Adam had all the knowledge, and this comes back to esoteric knowledge, like hidden knowledge, okay? So Adam had all the knowledge in the Garden of Eden. He wrote it down on two tablets in hieroglyphs. Noah took one of the tablets to Armenia after the flood, and this already somewhat diluted knowledge was taken up by four people. One became an astronomer, one became a magi, one a Kabbalist, and one an alchemist. So Abraham took it from Canaan to Egypt, where it spread, okay? And then Moses comes into play, because now he pegged Moses as a Kabbalist, but okay, and even as someone that could foretell stuff by, you know, using Kabbalistic numerology. He also had Hermes as one of these Egyptian prophets, and even Zoroaster or Zarathustra. So he describes how to make the Philosopher's Stone using salt, sulfur, mercury, by continually heating sulfur. But again, take this as a very kind of, you know, double meaning and you know, hidden meaning kind of thing. You break down the compounds to their elements until you get liquid gold, which, you know, that's, in his case, he sees medicine closer to the elixir of life. So liquid gold more like the elixir of life rather than Philosopher's Stone. And astrology is important to this. Like some steps of these processes, like in making medicine, you can only do under certain conditions, like certain zodiac signs, certain phases of the moon. Otherwise, and you know, he writes that otherwise you're just wasting your time. While I'm reading this, so while I'm reading all these kind of strange things, at the same time, and his ego comes back into play, he's discrediting other occultists. So he's saying, do this, but not like Ramon Lull did, ha ha ha, or Albertus Magnus, no. And then, but doing this and this and this, but not like Thomas Aquinas believes, or Geber, or, you know, you get the point. Like he's just, you know, in his writings, he's just mocking all the other alchemists. Right, mid-sentence, you know, mix the flour and water, but not like Ramon Lull, not like Betty Crocker, ha ha, are you kidding me? So it's kind of interesting.
His own PR agent, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he got in a lot of trouble. But I would put forth the argument that he definitely did some real contributions to science, which is what piqued my interest in the first place. Okay, so for instance,
zinc.
Yeah.
I mean, what people don't know, might not know, unless you're in these inner circles of thought, is that he is also credited for giving zinc its name, calling it zincum.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's based on the sharp-pointed appearance of its crystals after smelting it, and the old German word zinke. Is that right?
Zinke.
I was close, right?
Sure.
Zinke, for the word pointed.
I'll allow it.
All right, thank you. Danke. Healing wounds. And we talk about the idea of how we could take this knowledge base to the world of medicine, mm-hmm. right? And using it for the science of maybe healing people. He used experimentations and learning about the human body, which at the time still was probably very hard to get this information together, mainly because of the religious belief systems of being able to what people would call desecrating a body, getting more information about the body by doing autopsies.
Well, this is where the Reformation comes back
exactly.
Into play.
So people were actually still gaining a knowledge base on this. So using this new knowledge base, he would use experimentation and learning about the human body that was a little bit taboo at the time without being able to do autopsies because it was called desecration of the body. So, I mean, he was getting this really new knowledge base for many people. And he also would have hands-on experience, which would give him more importance than some of the bookworms out there that would mm-hmm. would just get their knowledge from reading what was written beforehand. Maybe some of that passed on false knowledge. So mm-hmm. he actually would get dirty. He would get in there and get the information by firsthand account. And he would do things such as like, when someone had a wound, he would just let it drain, naturally drain or heal itself versus taking leeches or bloodletting to heal the person.
Yeah.
Now people were still doing that up into the 19th century, thinking that bloodletting was
the best way to go. But he had some other ideas. Yeah,
right?
Sure.
Paracelsus was also responsible for the creation of laudanum, an opium tincture
mm-hmm.
that was very common until the 19th century, but also had a lot of negative effects, didn't it?
Yeah, you can't find it today. Like laudanum is the thing that they would mix with absinthe, get you really good times going.
You would have these dens in some major cities where people would just be wasting their life away on laudanum.
So that was laudanum, yeah. Right. It was like liquid opium that you would mix in with drinks and stuff.
Right. The word unconsciousness, he was credited with providing the first clinical scientific mention of the unconscious with the meaning of subconscious. Kids sometimes get sick because of something they say unconsciously imagine, mm-hmm. right? So you might say, well, really your subconscious is telling you that you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
I feel sick, right? So that's something that he coined.
What's really interesting is that he was revolutionary in a sense that although his medicine is based in hermeticism and astrology, right, like as above, so below, as in the microcosm, so the macrocosm, which we've heard a lot, he had the view that sickness is caused by an imbalance of minerals and therefore certain illnesses have chemical remedies. This is revolutionary at the time. To us, it's like, well, yeah, you're sick, you take some medicine. Because up until that point, you had Hippocrates' view of sickness. So that means that the illness was caused by one of the four humors being out of balance. Like, what bile, I don't remember what they are. It's disgusting stuff. So medicine at that point was, eating certain foods or purging, bloodletting, right? Like that kind of thing
humors back into balance. It is amazing how far we've come in medical sciences. And more so looking at it, Travis, that a lot of our discoveries and things we consider sacrosanct in medical knowledge today is relatively mm-hmm. recent. Just think about the not somewhat off topic, but just the study of the woman body.
Yeah.
I mean, for that's reasons even, that you can go on for another show, but I mean, the idea of gynecological science is really, really recent.
Yeah.
Within some of our lifetimes, where we're talking about some of these discoveries have been made. So,
mm-hmm.
He really kind of started the ball rolling, didn't he?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't want to be sick in the 8th century or even the 15th century. And if I were a woman, I would just never want to be sick, ever, until the 20th at least. So he challenged some of the standing beliefs by saying that illnesses can be caused by outside factors. This was already revolutionary,
This is before the concept of bacteria.
Exactly.
We
know
with
viruses
microscope.
And bacteria and all these things exist, but to them it was all, an imbalance. It comes back to, something happening within the body. Now, this is a famous saying. I'm going to paraphrase it, but a famous saying within toxicology is the dose makes the poison. So this is when they say that, they're paraphrasing Paracelsus, that poisons might be one thing, but in small doses, it could be healing or medicine, okay? After his death, something arose called Paracelsianism, which was a medical movement based on the theories and therapies of Paracelsus. It was prominent in the late 16th and 17th century Europe. So after his death, some of these professors finally kind of gave in and saw some of his wisdom. And
so his ego had dividends after his death.
Yeah, after,
you know, some people don't get that.
Then he was big. Yeah, I mean, yeah. People definitely started to study his ways because it did work a lot.
Looking at trivia related to him, I bet, you know, if you didn't know the name, you probably, if you think about it, you might have known the name. He's mentioned in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
He's along with Agrippa and Albertus Magnus. He's also mentioned in the Harry Potter films and in the books. If you remember, he's one of the collectible cards that comes with a chocolate frog,
uh-huh,
one that jumps away. He's only got one good jump in him.
Yep.
Remember Ron said that?
That's right.
I took my kids to see all those movies. It still sticks in my head. And he's mentioned also in the library, you'll see his name on one of the books, and his statue is at the famous Hogwarts for witches and wizards. So you'll see that. He's mentioned in Moby Dick, as many other places. So his name did get around. You're probably more familiar with him than you think.
Mm-hmm. And the bibliography tonight, this text that I was paraphrasing, where he disses all the other alchemists and talks smack about all the other occultists and all that, I got that from The Alchemist Reader by Stanton J. Linden. Well, thanks a lot for listening tonight. If you want to read more about him and other alchemists, please stop by historyofalchemy.com, and we'd love to hear from you. If you have ideas for future episodes, some feedback, questions, corrections, email us at podcast@historyofalchemy.com, and you do us a huge favor by finding us on iTunes and rating the show. That bumps us up the ratings a little bit. That's a great help.
We're not going to tell you to rate us at 5, but if you like 5...
You know, if you think we deserve a 5, rate us a 5.
All right. So just a quick little mention as well. You know, visit our sister podcast called Bohemican Podcast, and it's also located at bohemican.com. It's my website about Czech history, Czech pop culture, Czech literature, art, sports, you name it, anything that deals with the Czech Republic, Bohemia and Moravia included. It is there. And I try to give you as much information from an expat's viewpoint living here in the Czech Republic. So remember, we'll be back with you every 2 weeks, and we want to thank you very much for listening.
Yep, thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.